Greetings, listener. You're listening to Podcast with a K. Today, I was going to say starring. I think that gives us a little too much credibility. Featuring, a little better, but still perhaps a little too much like a guest star. sort of thing I imagine on a sort of Glenn Larson production in the 80s with the guests featuring Lorna Green or, you know. Fred Astaire, yeah, brilliant, Fred Astaire. So we won't go preaching. Is present, I think we'll go with. On this podcast is present, is myself, James McLean, and with me, equally present, Gareth Cavanagh.
Hello.
The true the K.
Well, yes, I guess. And you know, we've been here before, you know.
We have. We're recording this just started 2018. We did try and record this last week. We had technical issues, so I know we're probably one of the last podcasts to be talking about the Christmas episode, which, if that was not spoiler enough, we are talking about the Christmas episode. We're going to talk about some of the Facebook comments we've had on this as well, and we're going to give our general feelings and some sort of ideas of maybe where the show has gone right or where the show has gone wrong. That sounds like that's an even balance. Well, probably won't be. I'll just caveat that with that no one wants to really have a go at a show that they enjoy. I mean, I always compare this to like football teams. You know, you follow a football team, you know, you can have seasons where they don't do well, but it doesn't mean that you stop following the football team. You still go, you want it to do well. You know, you're a supporter. So that hopefully crushes any of the comments which go, well, if you don't like it, why do you watch it? Well, you know, you go to a football game.
Mm. Well, do you know, I remember bumping into Frank Skinner at the BFI when we saw the Power of the Daleks reunion. And Frank is quite famously a West Brom supporter, has been his whole life, as well as loving Doctor Who. And that year they were particularly awful to watch. And I said, you know, so how are you enjoying the football, Frank? You know, how are you enjoying West Brom? And he said, well, I wouldn't really characterise it as enjoying. He says, I like to think of it as when I go and watch West Brom, as being like one of those enormous, sprawling Soviet films, silent film masterpieces from the 20s, where someone's slogging through the tundra for 4 hours. He says, you know, you just kind of watch it and you accept that it is what it is. But I wouldn't say enjoying is the right word. And maybe that's sometimes how it is for Doctor Who. And it's okay to not like something as long as you're positive.
Nicely put. So, Christmas special. This was a Christmas special this year. For those who don't know, who are clearly stupid. Christmas special this year. Well, I'm saying it's stupid because why are you listening to this if you don't know? But it seems polite to pretend that you don't. Christmas special was the last one for Peter Capaldi. It was the last one for Stephen Moffat. It sort of finalised with a regeneration into the latest Doctor, which will be Jodie Whittaker. It starred Mark Gatiss. It starred David Bradley. Pearl Mackie was in there as well. So it's a hard one to really talk about because there's just so much going on and there's so many levels of it you can talk about. So I mean, I think we should start this with what we liked, because I think it's probably going to be a shorter chapter of this podcast.
Okay, yeah, let's talk about what we like,
but let's always start positive.
Always good start with the positive. You know, this is always when you're giving a critique, you should always start with the things you enjoy, because, you know, I think I'm sure people who, you know, yeah, let's start with what we liked. David Bradley, I think, did a very nice job caveating some of the material he was given of recreating the first Doctor.
You like?
I think I liked what he did. I liked his performance as the first Doctor.
Absolutely. Okay. Was there anything else? Okay. So you liked that him as a character. Was there anything else in the? Okay, as a positive, let's do it as relative positivism.
Yeah.
Compared to the previous Christmas specials, the last 4 years or so, how did it fare?
Well, I mean, nothing's as bad as the River Song Christmas thing.
Yes.
Which was the worst thing I think Doctor Who has coughed up in a few years. I sat down and watched it badly hungover with my mother on Christmas Day. That's the, is it the wedding of River Song?
Husbands of
River Song. Yeah, sorry, I do get mixed up. My mother has this brilliant thing of cutting through all of the chaff. And I sort of sat there waiting for it to get a little bit better, and it really wasn't. And she came in and watched it for a minute and said, I didn't know this was a comedy nowadays, dear, and then walked out. And the only other time she's done that is when I was sat there eagerly watching The Gunfighters on UK Gold almost 25 years ago. And she came in and I was watching it and she goes, gosh, this is a bit amateur, isn't it, dear? Especially by the usual, you know, even by the usual standards. And then walked out the door. So I go with my mother on this, you know. She's put up with a lot of Doctor Who over the years, like all of my family, you know. And sometimes we're able to see it with, you know, we're able to see with better eyes than them, you know. Not at all like the Horns of Nymon, which only very marvellous, clever people can see is a masterpiece. But nonetheless, occasionally people cut through it. And I think, I don't know what she would have made of this one. I suspect she probably would have just not understood it and tuned out.
Okay, so I know here we're sort of doing the idea of relativism. So with the Husbands of River Song, it's almost like saying, how do you prefer a scraped knee to having a bullet in the head? And therefore, suddenly the scraped knee seems really wonderful. Yeah. I personally thought it was watchable. I watched it and I didn't feel particularly irritated. When I watched the Husbands of River Song, I was annoyed all the way through. It seemed silly. It seemed uninterestingly silly. It seemed a load of set pieces which just didn't sit together well. They didn't give any particular enjoyment. And it just reinforced this narrative, which I didn't think was one that I particularly liked or thought was particularly charming or had chemistry. And furthermore, I was not concerned, but I felt that for a show which was having issues with the ratings, sort of exploring a character which was 2 years gone seemed, as the title
and never made much sense in the first place.
I just didn't feel it sort of give anything to the casual viewer. So there's loads of things I'd issue here, but with this one I didn't have those. I mean, yeah, I still think that this episode was way too fan focused. I think it was I'm never quite sure. I'm tentative to sort of say that Moffat made a mistake here. I'm not sure whether Capaldi was very keen on the idea of having the first Doctor with him because that would excite the fan in him, or whether in a sense that sort of got in the way of his final swan song. That should this really have just been about Capaldi, since this is his ending, and yet in the end it's actually more focused on the other guy than it is him. But maybe he wanted that. I don't know.
Okay.
But so,
let's go back to the positives then.
Yes, we seem to have slipped from the positives.
Let's stick with the positives. I thought Gatiss's captain was very nice. I thought that was a nice little character. I didn't feel any need for him to be a relative of Lethbridge Stewart, if I was being honest.
No.
But I like the scenes with Toby Whit, the brilliant scene with Toby Whithouse with the two of them at gunpoint in the crater. I thought that was nice. And actually, you know, I'd have been very happy for them to have done a show just in the trenches around the Christmas armistice and some alien thing trying to interfere with it. That would have been very nice and very festive, actually.
I've always said that I've always wanted Doctor Who to sort of go away from the big events. And it just would have been nice to have one in the trenches. Ignore the armistice, which I know keys into the Christmas theme, but just explore what life is without there being big names.
Christmas in the Trenches in 1916 or something like
exactly.
That.
Yes, exactly. Or that wonderful thing where you think it's going to be that and it's the wrong year. I had
that's the Blackadder joke,
yes,
isn't it?
It is,
hurrah,
yeah.
We lived through the Great War, 1914 to 1917. Yeah.
That's such a brilliant blow.
It is.
But yeah, I agree with you. And I think using Lethbridge Stewart, beyond the fact that I do know there have been questions of whether they should have,
that was fun in itself, though.
But I think, the issue for me is that you had a great opportunity to explore the unknown soldier, which is very much embodies the Great War, and you not ever knowing his name would have perhaps been more poignant and more.
Well, it would have made sense with the testament, I guess.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
These guys are not lost.
And they are just as important as Brigadier Leverett Stewart's uncle slash grandfather slash whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that was a big, big mistake. And again, indicative of a show which I kind of feel, and this again is a big jump, perhaps has too many people at the top who are Doctor Who fans and not enough people who have the power within that dynamic to be able to sort of say, you need to back off here. That's not needed. Why don't you do this? That might be more interesting.
Yeah.
The Lethbridge Stewart, probably if you've got Mark Gatiss, you've got Stephen Moffat, you've got Capaldi on the phone, Lethbridge Stewart probably sounds great. But perhaps there needs to be someone else in that power dynamic who can go, no, that's not really going to help. That sort of belittles your narrative here.
Yeah.
Maybe.
We do seem to come back to Lethbridge Stewart a lot in the Moffat era.
Yes.
And I'm guessing that's because he's a Pertwee man. He must be, Stephen Moffat. If his earliest memories are of Troughton, that means he hits Pertwee, you know, in that sort of sweet spot of sort of, you know, 9 or 10. So he's a Pertwee man at heart. So it must explain why there's this continuous need to come back to Lethbridge Stewart. You know, we've had Lethbridge Stewart on the phone. We've had Lethbridge Stewart resurrected as a rocket-flying Cyberman.
Mm-hmm.
We've had Lethbridge Stewart's daughter.
Yep.
We've now had Lethbridge Stewart's old man. I mean, God, poor old Nick Courtney. Not that he's worrying about this. Must be kicking himself that he croaked it in 2010 or 2011. He'd have been back earning money in a shop if he'd just hung on an extra year.
I know. But yeah, considering some of the natures of the story, would he have wanted to come? I don't know.
It's amazing how a decent paycheck and a couple of news stories at the conventions can re-energize the enthusiasm. He must be a Pertwee man. I mean, he must be. That must be his sweet spot as a kid.
Absolutely. I mean, and you've got other things which are, to me, a little ridiculous. That are those nuances which again say to me there's too much fan focus in there within the production. Is the whole thing of Gatiss's Planet of the Daleks Pertwee coat jacket hung in the TARDIS, which again is, I'm not saying that is any issue with the episode, I'm just saying, is that an issue with people who are just so in love with the show that are the things that are taking place here, are there too many focuses which are away from the mandate, which is to be a family show that intrigues the whole family? And is that, you know, it's just the danger of television now, where we are people who go into television are grown up and are massive fans within television, and that can sometimes be a problem. I love this Planet Earth police box that they had for the Hartnell police box. I thought that was fascinating to see, just from a historical point of view, to see it recreated with a lot of attention to detail. That interested me. There wasn't horrendously much in the episode which interested me. The dialogue was Moffat's usual witty, well played off, but ultimately what you've seen before, and probably what we're going to come to in a second, is a question of whether some of the stuff in there was appropriate for the First Doctor.
There were no lines that really made me go, oh wow, that's profound, I haven't heard that before. It was just, I tell you what I thought was odd as well, I don't know if it was cut, just sort of seeing in, they made a great deal about casting a new a new Ben and Polly, and that I thought we were gonna see a lot more of them and a lot more of the polar ice cap base, because there was lots of suggestion in the preamble. Oh, we've reconstructed. It's fantastic. And I think we saw it for about 10 seconds. I think Polly got a couple of lines and Ben got maybe one.
Gareth, you're right.
Yeah, I'm still here.
You're rattling around there. It sounds like you're actually wrestling with a Nymon, is how I imagine they would sound.
Oh, sorry, I was scratching my leg.
That's what a Nymon would sound like. It would.
I don't know whether all that got cut or whether they ran out of time or whether
Well, there's a lot of footage.
They wanted to do and didn't, but...
They've shown footage, haven't they, of a lot of stuff there, which, as you say, looks like was filmed or was certainly on set. Like, there was a Cyberman on set, the dead Cyberman, which people have said I'd like to have seen that. I thought the Ben and Polly was a big mistake, especially since you got that line later on where you got Capaldi says to Bradley, "Oh, your face looks a little different because you're mid-generation." And you think, well, that's a nice, weird sort of trying to excuse a different actor. But then why have you recast Ben and Polly if you're going to do that?
Well, yes, that's true. Yes. Yes. So they also look strange.
I mean, if I'd been doing it, I would have probably done just if I was that being sort of someone who's fascinated by era, I'd have thought it would have been a really good excuse and a way to make it a little more interesting is either to done over the shoulder shots of Ben and Polly so you don't see them, which I know is not great for the actor. If you're going to go down this line of trying to justify David Bradley, which I just don't think you did need to, or you do it from a point of view of the Doctor at that point and you can blur out bits. So
Or you could watch it on a low-res security monitor.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
that would be fine.
I mean, again, it's that whole thing that it doesn't matter, but there is that thing that if you are trying to connect or trying to recreate a world for a certain viewing audience, which I'm assuming you are to actually try and do it so authentically, as soon as you put in actors which can't look or can't be the actors of that time that those people are going to remember, you pull them out of that moment.
You do.
So
you do.
It just seemed like a weird thing to do.
It did. Oh, coming back to things we love.
Yes.
I did like the opening 709 episodes ago. I quite like that.
Yes, that was nice.
That was fun.
That was a nice
That made
time.
Me chuckle and that made me smile. And then we went into that and I thought, oh, this is going to be good. So for 30 seconds to a minute, I was actually quite excited.
I think that one of the problems for me was, and I know a lot of people have said this online, is that it felt like there was, I mean, looking at our Facebook page for Beyond Casterbrus, we've got Andrew Ford says, "I really enjoyed it. It was a bit thin on story, but the regeneration sequence was great." The really, the story just wasn't, I mean, you can almost, in your head, rattle off the set pieces. You've got the snow, the TARDIS, the Dalek world, World War One. The TARDIS, and that's it. There's nothing else really there, and nothing massively happens except a slight recycle of Missy's plot from the end of Series 8 with the taking of mines, taking
the data soul mine.
And then you've got.
Well, I tell you what, could you explain something to me? Because you're a bit cleverer than me on such matters. I didn't understand Rusty's story at all, and what he was doing in this tower, and why there were loads of naked Daleks scuttling around.
I got the point.
I just didn't get it.
I got the point that he was pretty much like one of the last Daleks who had spent his life fighting Daleks, and this was his sort of like his tower, which they couldn't, and he was just killing Daleks when they'd come and why they were then alive and running around down below. I don't know.
I didn't get that, I'm being honest.
And again, I know this is the nature. So to some degree, it's the nature of what Doctor Who does these days. But it is an inherently long callback. I mean, it's 3 years since Rusty.
Oh, hugely long.
And I didn't remember.
Think,
yeah.
Who is that? Oh, it's the broken one. Oh, it's Rusty. Yeah.
So again, it felt very, very.
And it looked absolutely outrageously cheap. It did look like a 60s Star Trek set. now, if that was the intention, that's terrific. But I don't think it was.
But it's a shame. I mean, if we talk about the 10-year of Moffat, I think what is kind of sad is that when he did Series 5, he was very, very keen, clearly on, well, almost, I could almost say rudely, wiping the floor with Russell T Davies's era. There was no mentions to it. There was a suggestion that the Dalek thing never happened.
True.
He wanted to. He was very forward facing, which
spent
I think
an awful lot of money. Yeah, that's true.
So he was looking at sort of going forward in his own era with his own style and not becoming too backward facing at all. And there wasn't that much to do with the old series either. There was a couple of things, and he obviously had bigger. I think the Big Bang had bigger ideas of having more classic monsters in there. But ultimately, he was pushing forward. And it's kind of sad at the very back end, since the 50th, he has become very backward facing. And this episode seems to typify that rather than typify what a lot of people see as his best work. I'm not quite sure I agree with it personally, but a lot of people really love Series 5.
I think Series 5 hangs together very it's the only one to me that hangs together satisfyingly as an arc. I think that Stephen Moffat does, you know, I'm very conflicted about Stephen Moffat, I'll be quite honest. To me, he writes the best of Doctor Who and the worst of Doctor Who. You know, some of his episodes, I would say, are up there as my absolute favourites of all time. Girl in the Fireplace, Heaven Sent. You know, these are great, absolutely great pieces of drama, great shows, great within their own right. But I think he's terrible at doing seasons. And I think that his season arcs very rarely pay off. I think he increasingly falls back to just quick flashbacks just to tie things up. You know, the silence famously never really paid off.
No.
I mean, just to sort of quickly tie it up in a 30-second voiceover in the anniversary one. Oh, no, the one after the anniversary one, I don't think it's really good enough. I think that I think The Impossible Girl doesn't really work. I think that Amy and Rory doesn't really work as a device. So he's not very good at those for me. And I also think he's not very good at you know, he writes companions as puzzle boxes to be fixed.
Yes.
I seem to remember, you know, reading that somewhere. I thought, God, that is about right. He doesn't tend to, you know, he doesn't write. The nearest he got this was last year was Bill, which is the only time he's written a companion who isn't there as something for the Doctor to solve.
But there was talk, I'm not sure the details, there was other people involved with Bill as well.
I have heard that.
So yeah. I don't know, but that could be right, that could be wrong. But I think, my problem with him is I think, yes, I agree with you. I think he's an incredible writer. And even though sometimes his funny lines irritate me where he places them, there's no doubt that he's a very witty man. He's very articulate and smart in how he writes his comedy.
Without doubt.
I kind of think the problem with him is that Doctor Who is just too big a role to show, run, produce. And if you look at Davis, who had, as far as I'm aware, had far greater producing experience.
Yeah, no, he did.
And you saw how he struggled. And I just don't think Moffat could cope with that. And, of course, Sherlock on the back as well. And that's what damaged a lot of his ideas and his series arcs, which I think every series arc, from what I understand, went a different way to what was pretty much planned. Series 5 went a different way to what was planned.
Yeah.
River Song did, as far as I'm aware. The Day of the Doctor obviously did. I think, to be fair, with Impossible Girl, I think Coleman was back and forth with uncertainty of what she was doing, and he was trying to work that out as well. So there was, you know, it's not always his fault, but I think a good producer a really good producer, which is what I think you need to be for something like Doctor Who, can manage those issues. And I just think it was probably too big a monster for someone to produce, for someone who's perhaps not that sort of person.
And it's a killer in terms of ideas. You know, Russell has 4 years and then he's exhausted.
Yes.
The specials don't really count because they're not supposed to exist. He's supposed to go, and then he's supposed to go to America, reboot Doctor Who, off he goes. So the specials... And I think that this shares a similar problem in microcosm to Russell's final year, in that Russell has his perfect end of era story with the Stolen Earth Journey's End. And then it's like, oh, well, thanks for your perfect end, Russell. We now need you to find another end in a year's time. And for me, Capaldi already has his perfect ending at the end of last season. And if he just regenerates, you know, in the ash, I think that's fine. You know, in the same way that the Master goes off and regenerates. In the same story, and he's already said everything he needs to say, and Bill is in a place of safety, it's the perfect moment to regenerate. It does not need this extended coda. Which is what the Christmas special is.
Which is kind of funny, because I was yesterday, just by chance, on YouTube, I ended up watching the Children in Need special between Parting of the Ways and The Christmas Invasion. And
yes.
This ultimately feels like that. It feels like an unneeded story, which
it's
tells
exactly
you a piece
is.
Between, yeah. Which it obviously is not quite as neat because she is now falling out of the TARDIS and everything.
Yeah.
So it's not quite, but it feels, I totally agree. It feels, because my issue again, and we talked about this last week in our failed podcast, is that I don't
yes.
totally get Capaldi's Doctor in a sense that
no.
when it comes to his final moments, I feel uncertain. I just don't feel it's him. And yet I feel it's more Peter than it is the Doctor. And I think that is a problem with this production of this particular Doctor, is that he swings from being very alienated, very uncertain how to deal with people, very pragmatic in his way of being a hero, to this character which is unstable to a point which makes Tennant look stable, where he would bring the whole universe crashing down to get Clara back, or he would do anything to protect Bill. You know, there's, and I just, so his final speech just feels, I don't know, it just doesn't feel like the Doctor that originally
appeared.
No,
it's needy, and I'm a little bit sick of these big speeches, to be honest.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, going back to things that we loved.
Yeah.
I absolutely loved the introduction of Jodie's Doctor.
So did I. Yeah, absolutely.
It was a complete masterclass in less is more. You know, we didn't get a sort of hooting and running around the TARDIS and I'm not Ginger yet and all that rubbish. It was literally just, you know, thrilling, exciting, exuberant. You know, just oh, brilliant was fine. It felt like a different show in that one period, and her being ejected from the TARDIS and the wedding ring dropping off, which, to my shame, I hadn't even noticed the Doctor wearing a ring at all. I don't think anyone had, to be honest. I don't think it was ever really telegraphed, was it?
No, it wasn't. But again, and it's interesting whether that was symbolic of a new era or whether that was, as we've said before, whether that was
yeah.
just to show that she was a different size. And
yeah.
What was?
I don't think it was him showing he's not married to River Song anymore. I just think it was literally, I would imagine that was improvised on the day when it's like, oh, yeah, let's get rid of the ring. That's a bit like Power of the Daleks, isn't it? Oh, yes. And as a device, it's fine. Although I'd never seen any reference to him wearing a wedding ring, because it's Capaldi's own wedding ring, I think, isn't it?
I'm not sure.
That's what I was told.
Hmm.
Anyway, yeah, but that was great, and that felt like a brand new show, and her falling out the TARDIS, perfect, absolutely perfect.
Yeah, I found, I don't know. I mean, it was an odd regeneration. It's sort of, again, and I still wonder, and I, this isn't any knock on Peter. I wonder whether what he wants to be, or, you know, being a fan of the show, to what suits the character sometimes is at conflict. So I get the impression that he was given, from what Stephen Moffat suggests anyway, that he was given a lot of input in this final episode to be the outfit he wants, especially in that last speech. And I kind of feel there's this sort of mixture of him being in pain, struggling, and yet still standing and making these long monologues to no one. And I'm not even sure that character would make a monologue to himself to the next one. Maybe he would, but I don't know. I just find it frustrating that Doctor Who has got to this point now where, I mean, I always say, you know, a person can still be the same person, but when I'm drunk, I'm a very different person to when I'm sober. When I am 17, I was making mistakes that I would hopefully not make now. You know,
oh, that's true.
We
yes.
You know, it goes back to Matt Smith's speech, you know, that we're constantly changing, and that's absolutely fine.
Oh, we are.
As long as
yeah.
you remember who you are, you know, that's great. But with the Doctor, it seems to constantly coming back to his core personality, overriding that persona of the Doctor, and therefore that weakens the persona of the Doctor. So Capaldi becomes this last speech feels like it could have been made by any of them. It didn't feel
yeah.
like it was indicative of who Peter Capaldi's
well,
Doctor was. And
all of Stephen Moffat's Doctors kind of sound the same.
Yes,
to be honest.
Yes, that's what
I find, being honest, I don't, you know, whoever he writes for, they're always the same. It's the Terrence argument. Now that's fair enough, but that's why for me the biggest regeneration is a brand new showrunner, because
yes.
I think whoever's in that seat after 7-8 years, it's just too long.
Yeah, oh, I totally agree. It's not necessarily about him. It's about a tenure,
no.
which is just
They repeat themselves, they retrench, they explore things of interest to them. They exhaust themselves of ideas. They inevitably repeat themselves. You know, Russell was repeating himself by the end and doing things that he liked. They all were. They all go back to things that they like and they enjoy. And I think this episode was indicative. But it is an extended coda, and I think that's the problem. You could cut it out. I'm also not a fan of huge overblown regeneration episodes, which have become the norm in recent years. You know, I was thinking back about this after we did the chat the other day that didn't record, and I thought, you know, the big one, which is a real important one in the modern era, is, I guess, it's going to be Eccleston's regeneration, because that's the first time that audience has seen that whole concept. It's exciting. And it's over in, you know, I think, you know, Eccleston has about 30 seconds of really nice dialogue and then it's gone.
Do you know what interested me about that regeneration? I was watching it yesterday because that was the one that segued on YouTube into the time crash, Children Need One. Yeah. Is that when he explodes into regeneration, I was thinking, this first time, is that actually just meant to be the release of the time vortex that he's swallowed? Is that actually...
That would make an awful lot of sense.
And that has become the visual motif for regeneration. But in the sense of that moment, I actually think it's meant to be him releasing all that time vortex energy.
It's a bloody good idea. It makes all the sense, doesn't it, really?
And that has now changed, and, you know, that's the way things go. But, no, I totally agree with you. And I think that his second regeneration, the Tenant one, is very powerful in the sense that whether you like the length of it, and I know a lot of people found it overblown and melodramatic, I get that, that's fine. There is no dialogue.
But he doesn't say anything. He just says, I don't want to go.
And that's very powerful.
That's wonderful. Yeah. I think less is more, you know.
Or maybe it's not necessarily less is more, but diversity and difference is what's important. And we've just not had that since.
It's been wordy and mawkish. So,
I felt like
I was watching a different show in the last 2 minutes.
Which is your favourite regeneration of the whole series? What one do you think...
That's difficult. I suppose Davison in Caves of Amzarni was a real divergence at the time.
Yes.
And this idea of this sort of internal conflict was very nice. But then I absolutely hate the stuff that comes after it. I hate all the Colin Baker smugness and expect someone else. It's almost like, you enjoyed this show, now you can piss off and watch All Grief Is Great and Small. So, difficult. I suppose the Pertwee one is very nice.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's an idea that he's been slowly dying in the TARDIS and erratically flying around the time vortex for months is horrifying. Mm.
Or years in some of the new adventures, it suggested years.
Yeah, I mean, that's awful. Mm. I actually quite like the Eighth Doctor's regeneration that we see.
Yeah.
In that little mini-sode.
Yeah.
Probably helped by the fact he only has 6 minutes to play with.
Yes.
Certainly... It's crisp and it cuts and it's done.
And it has meaning as well. And I think
that
was the other problem with regeneration. And it goes back to my dislike of the very last episode of the series is that it felt as if he didn't. Again, I think you're right. It comes back to someone who feels they're out of ideas. And there's no real. I didn't get any emotion out of his regeneration. I didn't. Not that maybe it should always have it, but it felt like he didn't know how to do it. So the Cyberman shoots him. But that's not good enough because he can't just regenerate then. So it's sort of, let's hold it off again so we can do some more drama and then we'll deal with that later. It feels like there's no, you know, Caves of Androzani's got a very specific mandate to it.
Oh, he's dying from 5 minutes in.
Yeah.
And he doesn't know it until end of part two.
I mean, John Pertwee's, you've got the hubris, which is an interesting concept. Legopolis has got portents, which is quite a foreboding concept for the first time. I mean, even the McCoy regeneration, the brutality of it is actually quite interesting. You know, this is a guy who is just used to just walking out of his TARDIS and then just get shot. And yeah, it's from the first time. So, okay, I kind of like that.
There's a delicious irony to that. You know, the great chess master, the doctor who's four steps ahead of everyone else.
Yes.
Randomly gunned down, stepping out of the TARDIS in San Francisco. It is quite nice in that sense.
So, absolutely. So, actually, we should probably go to some of the comments here, a few more of them.
Yes.
I'm going to just run through some of them. We've got Katie Poole, who says, on first impressions, I really enjoyed it. I'll even forgive it for the Clara moment. I thought it did a good job of being Christmassy enough whilst also having having enough actual plot. So she thinks there was enough plot, but...
Okay.
Not, it wasn't too Christmassy, which I must admit, I do agree. I've always said they need to get away from the trite Christmassiness.
We do hate planet Christmas.
Yes, right? Yeah. It's just like you don't, you know, Christmas episode doesn't have to be about Christmas, and this sort of wasn't, so that was good. The big overblown soppy moments were fewer than I expected and not as overblown as I expected. It's almost as if Moff learnt restraint. No one is more surprised than me. We've got, let's have a look. Jonathan Appleton said, found it pleasantly watchable overall. The story hung together well, I thought. Still doubtful about the decision to bring the first Doctor back, and indeed whether we really needed the story at all, given the events of the last season finale. He agrees with you. Had hoped to see a little more of Jodie, which I think all of us did, but set things up.
Oh, no, less is more. Less is more. Less is definitely more.
Are we in for a season-long quest to find the TARDIS?
Hope not.
I hope not, but there is talk of it being more earthbound and maybe trying to shift the goalposts a little. I keep saying they need to try and do something different. So,
I'm good with that. I'm good with that.
Nigel Webb said, lots of love. The mention of Chroma started me off. I thought the delivery from Capaldi was excellent as usual. Yes, he was good all the way through. But I thought this was particularly striking as he was somewhat restrained in his final speech. Not trying to grandstand, but giving some... advice to his successor. The inclusion of the Christmas truce I didn't see coming and was handled well. I thought it was a bit... I never liked the truce because I'm always in my head is the next day after this, one of them's going to be killing the other. It's kind of...
Well,
grotesque.
I remember watching a documentary on that and yeah, it has become a little bit sort of... Yeah, it's wonderful. I mean, the reality was that the truce went on for days and then the top brass panicked and shelled a load of their own troops fighting again. Because they thought, oh my God, you know, by New Year's Day, no one's going to be fighting, and that won't do.
So, yeah, there was a little, a very traditionalist approach to that idea.
Yeah.
I thought some of the David Bradley mannerisms, this is Nigel again, of the Doctor were spookily good. Loved the Bill and Nardle had a last cuddle with the Doctor, and the new Doctor is now from Yorkshire.
I was really pleased to see Nardole back, actually, because I sometimes think he gets a little bit forgotten.
Mm.
That he was a companion.
I'd like to see...
Well, no, he was an assistant, wasn't he? Not the companion. He was the assistant. Yeah.
And he says, and this is something I've seen a lot, and I didn't get this from the scene, and I'm pretty social justice warrior peeved that this is what people got from it. Oh, and interesting to see that the TARDIS does not like another woman in control of her. And... I don't know. I mean, I know he's Nigel's saying it's a joke, and he's looking forward to the future, so... I didn't get the impression he's been particularly he's not trying to be serious there, but no. I've seen a lot of people who are very pro Jodie making that same joke and it or variations on it, and yeah, I just kind of feel that sort of thing could have happened with any of the Doctors. I never felt it was particular to her. It was the sort of thing I could imagine any of them being written to do because that becomes a trope.
I remember I had a friend who was the son of a vicar and he'd heard every vicar joke. You know, and it's like when I used to have the pub and you'd go to a wedding and I'd hear the same thing, don't drink all the profits. And it's like, oh, I've never heard that one before, you know, and then you go to the next person and go, oh, don't drink all the profits. So I think sometimes, you know, there's a well-meaning reach for the obvious lever.
Yes, that's what I mean. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not, I don't take that as being negative in any way, no. But it's just interesting that that is how people see it. As a society, that's the first thing that springs to your head. And, you know, oh, women drivers. That sort of thing has been said a lot of times. We've got Chuck Burhane, who says, I will miss the chemistry between Bill and the Doctor. Too bad it took so long to find him a more suitable companion. But I think the character's presence as a diminished memory, as a memory, diminished the story for me. Above average story for the series. A very average regeneration. But I did enjoy the bits with the First Doctor, and while making it special, it too may have been a distraction from Capaldi's exiting. So, yeah, I agree with that. Mm-hmm. Alan John Scott simply said slow, like a lot of the newer stuff. Peter Servium said disappointing. Nick Caulfield, I'll watch it again in a short while. That'll help me pin down my thoughts, which he continues on then. Oh, he never didn't get time to watch it. But yeah, so let's see if we've got else here. Randy Holmes Coates, just checking. Oh, this is a public. It was just starting to think, should I be reading out their names? Is that do they want to be named on this? They're on a public group. It's a public group.
It's a public group, and I always think it's to be honest, you should be doing it in the style of Points of View with Barry Took.
Yeah, I just think, you know, I mean,
why?
It's just weird because I think back, you know, 30, 40 years ago when Swap Shop was going on, it amazed me when I saw clips of it where they'd actually read out the entire address of a child.
Oh, wow.
Down to the street name, street number.
So if you picked up a dodgy kaplunk off someone, you could actually go to their house in Gleethorpes and demand your Airfix, you know, Harrier jump jet back off them.
Or anything far more, you know, malevolent. You know, there was a really, the naivety is quite surprising. But yeah, I mean, there's a couple of here that interest me. I'm trying to be cautious that not to be picking. Bob James said, a fitting send-off, fitting enough, for me, as I depart the realm of televised Doctor Who. Another gentleman...
I know a few people who are doing this.
Yeah.
Some are doing it because of Jodie. Some are doing it because Chris Chibnall's taking over. One incredibly erudite and considered and an intelligent friend of mine has said, that's it, it's the Chib exit. I hate what he did with his episodes. I can't watch. And we always go, yeah, you'll be watching secretly, telling us it's terrible. But no, he's convinced he won't watch it again, which I find extraordinary. I mean, unless Nick Griffin was suddenly made showrunner, I can't see myself not watching it because of the person in charge.
I think the biggest mistake here is that people have, and I'm obviously starting off on a basis that I'm right and they're wrong, which is never a good approach. But to me, Doctor Who has always been, as we said this last week, it's always been part of its time. You look back to the to the 80s, aside from Juliet Bravo, which itself was quite groundbreaking. Women didn't have lead roles on television, not in mainstream dramas that weren't aimed at women.
Well, yeah, that's right. Yeah, outside of the soaps. That's true.
So this sort of stuff couldn't happen. But that doesn't mean that this stuff shouldn't have happened, or if the opportunity was there. The point is, this isn't a new idea to the show. The show is a progressive show about an alien that has transformed itself into a story about a time-travelling alien who can change his look, which is not relevant to his previous persona, so it's not a rejuvenation, it's regeneration. So they can be young, old, Scottish, Northern, English. They can be any type of person, and he is a person who looks after everyone, no matter who they are, what situation they're in, providing, you know, they are not causing harm. He is there to help, so he carries, in theory, no prejudice. He's a man of no prejudice. He is progressive, which is one of the issues of this episode, is the Capaldi character is progressive while the Hartnell one isn't. But he is meant to be a progressive character. And yet we are now saying we need to draw a line about who he can represent, because he can only represent white males. Or maybe some would say he can represent different racial males, but he has to be male. And you've got to then say, why is this Willy? Why is this genitals? Why is this informing?
Yes,
a line that he cannot cross in being progressive. Surely the point is that this is a character, not a gender, who is there to represent and protect us all. So why are we saying,
although it's interesting that both of our showrunners to date who would consider themselves to be very, very progressive people, have, when it comes to it, both cast, all cast white males.
Yeah. But again, is that...
Well, Russell, I suppose, to be fair, cast both of his doctors in the space of 12 months.
True.
Back when the TV landscape, I mean, 2004, 2005 does feel like an awfully long time ago now.
Yes, it does, doesn't it?
It really does. So I think Russell has a bit of a get out of jail. If Russell was casting in 29, 2010, you know, if I would be shocked if he isn't looking at people like Sacha Dhawan and you know, all of those quality black and minority ethnic actors that are out there.
I mean, I still feel there is still a bit of a resistance to even minority males. I mean, aside from Idris Elba, which I think people seem to think would be brilliant, but beyond, I still feel that that line is as tense, perhaps not quite as tense as the gender line, but it would still be a difficult line to cross in terms of...
I think there would be, you would get the usual, you know, political correctness gone mad, blah, 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 blah. And I think on the other side, you know, poor old Davison got dragged into into the Twitter wicker man and set alight for saying he wasn't immediately enthused by the idea of a woman doctor because, you know, don't we need intelligent, thoughtful, non-violent, well, you know, we'll take that in quotes, non-violent leads on television.
Well, he was
to younger people.
He was concerned of the male role model.
Yeah.
Which I understand people's concerns. I mean, I'm slightly against that on the basis, and people go, oh, social justice warrior. I just tend to think that we just need to be looking for good role models. And I'd rather not have to think that we need to try and criteria what makes a good... I'm not even sure what a good male role model is any more than what a good female role model is, beyond the fact of them being a good role model. So, but I don't feel that sort of point of view is one that needs to be chastised, because it's a point of debate. It's a positive point of debate.
It is a positive point.
It's not one that should be knocked back.
I think the problem we have with this whole debate is that there are elements on both sides, and I include the pro doctor must be a woman side, that actually are quite intolerant of, you know, they would be quite happy to no platform the other side completely, which is what happened to Peter, that he was essentially no platformed by Twitter.
Yes.
By elements of Twitter. And I'm uncomfortable with that. But oddly enough, I went to watch The Last Jedi, as I think I said, on New Year's Eve.
Yes.
I loved it. Absolutely loved
Brilliant.
It. And I didn't get the fan backlash. But what I like that they've done brilliantly is they have rebalanced the leads between, you know, genders and minority ethnic.
Yeah.
And it still feels like Star Wars. So...
Given how Star Wars was, was very much male-gendered, very, very, very racial...
Yeah, well, there was only two women in the whole of the rebellion,
and one black character in the whole series, if we ignore
Indeed.
James Earl Jones, yes. And that's and they've totally rebalanced that without it feeling to me anyway, as if social justice or whatever. And we have one gentleman here. I'll just say Ted said a disappointing ending to Doctor Who story. Moffat really killed the franchise, moving it from sci-fi to social politics, and that again. Like I said, I still think that this would have been done earlier. I think the show's always been about social politics.
Has Ted actually watched the Russell T. Davis era?
Or even Robert Holmes? Or,
indeed.
You know, 1970s was incredibly filled with social and cultural politics.
Having said that, I think Ted may... I can understand Ted's perspective solely on that episode, because... It is a little bit of a character assassination on the First Doctor, who is there really just so Capaldi's Doctor can show how progressive and wonderful he is.
If that's what Ted meant, then I apologise to Ted Brennan.
Yeah, if you just watch that episode, that is fair.
I thought he was just referring to the to the Whittaker. Jodie Whittaker.
If he's referring to that, then
there is crass social politics in there. You're right, and I think this was one of the issues we talked about last week, which was a problem for us, was how the first Doctor, and I think it's dangerous if we say the Hartnell Doctor, the first Doctor is sort of used as a bridging point to challenge 60s, 20th century social politics. They sort of kind of lump the Lethbridge Stewart character in with the Hartnell character, and they're meant to sort of almost like they existed in the same social sphere and social context, despite one being in a position where women couldn't vote and the other being in a position of the 60s which did have a lot of social progression as much as it did have boundaries still.
It's a great shame. As I say, I didn't really recognize the first Doctor from that, I'm afraid. It's, you know, arguably there's the smack bottom line from the from the Dalek Invasion of Earth, which is just really poor writing. There's the scene in the TARDIS in the Five Doctors where the Doctor demands that someone goes off and makes him tea, and it's Tegan that he's looking at. So, ergo, he's a casual sexist who just looks at his companions as people to bring him pineapple and tea. And that's it. The Five Doctors really shouldn't count in this, because that's Terence, I guess, broadly remembering what the first Doctor is like, and it's Herndl reinterpreting the role and doing a sort of a reasonable pastiche of Hartnell and adding a couple of little bits on the top. But to base the whole thing on that scene, which is more or less what he seems to have done, it doesn't seem to be particularly fair to sacrifice a character like that to make some fairly cheap jokes.
Well, it felt like a spitting image satire, you know, just sort of a crass satire, using the characters to play on a bigger social commentary rather than a show that was talking of... Yeah, I mean, even the Five Doctors scene, I mean, the Herdnall's not talking specifically to Tegan, as I recall. That it is Turlough and Tegan, and it's Turlough who says, you know, thank you, and walks out.
That's right.
So it's not really about gender.
That doesn't count. No. So I tell you what it is. I think it is. It's something that fandom has done for a while, and Hartnell's been increasingly used as a comedic figure because it's our way of dealing with, a comedic sort of antediluvian, anti-progress character, because that's how we imagine Hartnell was like as a man, you know. Yes. And there's Annika Wills has been gone on record for a long time saying he was a miserable, curmudgeonly, racist, sexist, unpleasant man. Not everyone shares that view, it must be said, but enough people do that has crystallized in the, in the consciousness. And, you know, I mean, I've written for fanzines where we've conflated Hartnell with the first Doctor and made him out to be this sort of, you know, real stick in the mud. You know, everyone's had a joke about, you know, what would Hartnell make of Captain Jack and all these sort of things. And I think if the honest answer would be, yes, Hartnell would have hated him and would have quite happily, you know, dropped him snow in a vat of acid and had him screaming for mercy. Maybe, or maybe he wouldn't. Hartnell was above all a professional, and we don't really know. But the first Doctor, there is no indication that he's sexist. There's no indication that he's racist. There's no indication that he is homophobic. I haven't seen anything to suggest that in any of the material that I've seen.
And there's a funny irony that, in a sense, that according to Moffat, he brought Bill back because he needed someone to sort of use to foil these 60s conventions with, who is progressive. And there's a sort of a kind of irony that we have the now contemporary society sort of watching this show and sort of mocking the sort of Bill Hartnell and the 60s boundaries of social conventions with gender and the like and sexuality, as if we are progressive. At the same time, we are dealing within this very episode with an issue where there's a large minority, shall we say, of fans of the show who do not want a woman being the Doctor. So there seems to be a quite interesting sort of confliction that we are not perfect enough to be sort of making these sort of snide sort of suggestions that the 60s was very backward in its understanding of women and sexuality, when in itself we are sitting in a situation where this is a hot pot of discourses around whether a woman can be the doctor. It kind of feels, which is no, again, it's nothing about Moffat or its writing there, because he's obviously made his stance is clear. But I think as a society, we're not really in a position to be overly lauding the 60s yet, when we've still
let's put it this way, I think they throw the first Doctor under the bus because he's dead and it's an era that they're not personally attached to. Now I think you could have just as easily have brought back Sean Pertwee, stuck him in that in the velvet jacket and used him as the foil for every single sexist jibe and point that you want to make, that I used to be this awful, you know, port drinking sexist, you know, London club using, you know, small C conservative, now I'm a proper citizen of the universe, wasn't I awful, Bill? You know, I mean, but they wouldn't do that because they love the third Doctor, so they're willing to see past any difficulties with the character.
Yeah,
I just thought it was cheap.
I mean, it'd been kind of nice if they played on some of the things which were inevitably part of the first Doctor. Is if some of his lines were slightly wrong, you know, and he sort of said, you know, we need to get back to Spain, and this sort of Spain.
Oh,
I said space, you know.
I loved all that.
That's the thing. Or he needs to sit down a lot and rest, because actually, you could play those in.
Well, yeah, but let's be honest. He's picked the wrong Hartnell era Doctor to do, because by the end he's a genial old buffer who wants to get involved, a citizen of the universe. If they'd chosen to take early Hartnell first Doctor out of time, when he is, you know, he doesn't want to get involved. He's very suspicious. You know, he's not attached to the human race at all in the slightest. Every single time in the adventure, he just wants to get back to the TARDIS and for him and Susan to be safe. And in that Maslow's pyramid, you know, him and Susan are at the top. Ian and Barbara are notionally below, and then everyone else is well below that because they're just there to serve him and his needs, you know. Mm. Ergo, persuading the pacifist Thals to invade the Dalek city purely because he wants his fluid link back. I think there's a lot to explore in that character, and that would have been interesting, and a really interesting dramatic counterpoint where, you know, because the first Doctor does change as well, where there is a point where four or five stories in, he actually does want to get involved. He doesn't want to just get out there or observe, gently observe from the outside and not get involved. So there was a great first Doctor story to be told and a real reason for him to be there, and he didn't go for it, unfortunately. He did go for instead the cheap jibes about dusting and women made of glass and all sorts of things, which I just don't think fit the Hartnell first Doctor that we see.
No.
So a great shame.
And I think, again, it becomes cruel as well, but to some degree. Well, I was going to say, I think it becomes cruel when the Doctor of a period becomes tarnished by the period, and the sense that there's certain things that the Doctor will do or won't do which will be related to the conventions of the culture at that time. And I don't know whether we should then be sort of staining them with that sort of thing, because the Doctor wasn't racist. He wasn't sexual. He wasn't... he didn't have any. He didn't suggest that he had any sexual issues with lesbianism. He didn't really. He wasn't particularly different to girls. I mean, he was very protective of his daughterly characters, be it Vicky or Susan.
But yeah, there's a sort of ward. That, you know, there's a ward, and then there's his grown-up companions.
And so,
I mean, you know, Ian and Barbara are treated very much as equals once they've all settled down.
Well, this is it.
It's not, it's not like he discusses all the big things with Ian and then Barbara's just told to get the tea and, you know, missed a bit there.
There's an incredibly powerful scene, which someone reminded me of, at the end of Edge of Destruction, where he sits down with Barbara and he has to apologise. And and the way that Jacqueline Hill plays it, it is a very strong female scene in the fact that she was right. She doesn't have to apologise. She accepts his apology without having to be overly patronising, just very on equals. And then they go out as equals. And I think, you know, to some degree, by celebrating the silliness of the 60s and, you know, our cultural memory of the 60s, sort of takes away from what the show was doing in a time where, yeah, it did slip up occasionally and was, you know, oh, Polly, go and get the tea, as Troughton, I think, you know.
Well, that's the moon base, that's Troughton. That yeah. says more about Jerry Davis than it does
well, this is
about
it.
Anyone this... else making the show.
So in the end, how it's written and how the writers existed within a society, therefore, is the issue that you shouldn't be attacking, but if you're going to make commentary, it should be on them, not the characters, the long-term characters themselves, which didn't suffer these, you know. So, yeah, I think there was an issue.
You should make
there.
The points about Star Trek, let's be honest.
Yes.
Which, apart from... Every, you know, every female character in that is there just to carry things and look decorative and be seduced by Kirk. Apart from Uhuru, who gets to wear an earpiece and twiddle with things. But she's still very much, you know, the switchboard operator in the office. She's not making any serious decisions. You know, Star Trek is a boys' club. And you know, if the Doctor was landing, if Hartnell was landing on planets every week and seducing someone every week, or even Ian, I think they'd have a point, but they
yes,
don't.
Exactly.
Doctor Who stays away from that. You know, we haven't even spoken about the Aztecs, is Barbara's story, which has some staggeringly good material in there for Barbara, but also the scenes where Hartnell's just pleading with her, saying, you know, you can't change history. Believe me, I've tried. You know, there's all that in there. This is not Terence's idea of the companion, which is actually, you know, they're there to be rescued by the Doctor and be tied to the railway track. You know, so we're back to the writers sometimes being the problem, not necessarily the actors or the era.
And again, we will see when it comes back whether that is still an issue, whether the, you know, I mean, I kind of feel, and I always feel bad when we do this, when the person's not there to be able to counter, but I kind of feel that from past experience of his writing, if Moffat was doing a Jodie era, the first few comments would be on the gender, would be on, as he did when the male regenerated into the female in Hellbent.
Curse of Fatal Death.
And in Curse of Fatal Death,
say,
you know.
But I was going to say it'll be a toned-down Curse of Fatal Death.
But Hellbent was the first thing when he did the Gallifreyan changes is a gender comment. And, you know, I am kind of... I am tentative that are we in a position yet where we can write a character which is essentially gender neutral, where anyone, an actor or an actress, can come and play that character without us having to be aware of what sex they are? Because that would be the ideal.
It's a very 80s convention, actually, that the Doctor is this sort of... It's only in the 80s that the Doctor becomes almost this sexless being.
Yes.
There's certainly a virility to Pertwee's incarnation of it, no doubt about it. There's a certain... Well, and there isn't there in Tom Baker's era, I guess.
But this is...
Because they're accenting the alien. But yeah, when you get to... There isn't... Actually, no, that's not fair either. Davison's got plenty of sexual chemistry going on, but mostly with the guest stars. So Polly James, Neris Hughes... You know, he quite happily flirts his way through quite a few of those stories.
But that is fine, because the character is still written as a character rather than a gender. It's the actor or actress who brings that. And now, if she brings a sort of slight flirtatious fun to it, and that is her persona being... That is fine. She should be able to do what she wants to do. But the character, to me, is not... And we sort of say, you know, he should typify a good male, but he's not... I don't think he just needs to typify a good person. And then, as I kind of hope as we go forward, and I'm sure someone again will say social justice warrior or whatever, political correctness gone mad, but I think we should be moving towards a point where gender becomes less of an issue and we're able to actually watch a character without being about...
Having said that, I think this is the one fresh big idea that Russell brought to it when he brought it back, that the Doctor... was a being of feelings and love and remorse, that he had all of those. He was capable of everything that the human race is capable of in terms of love and regret. And the relationship with Rose felt very real and very strong and very tangible. And he never really revisited that after that. But he kept the Doctor as being capable of those feelings and those rages. So maybe it's Russell that screwed the pooch on that one.
but even then, if they wanted to go down that line and wanted to have chemistry, you can still do that without it being gendered, because otherwise you'd be arguing that only one gender can fall in love with or show love to one other gender or be of one gender. So she could still have a chemistry with a... But it shouldn't be about... My concern is that it's written about her being a woman, where I don't think it needs to be. I think especially at the moment where there's issues within society and certainly within fan bases as well, because I don't think you should be there to try and piss people off. You know, let her be the Doctor. Let her bring the femininity to it without this overstatement, which television does, which, I mean, I say this all the time. I say, when I have conversations with my friends, and a lot of them are girls, the fact that they're a girl and the fact that I'm a guy very rarely comes up. We don't really talk about breasts or periods or penises or whatever. No. It doesn't. We talk as people. And I think we, as television, we need to be showing that we are people first, gender second. And that this is a very good opportunity to do that and let the actress bring...
Which is something that The Last Jedi did really well.
Yes, absolutely.
Although, I don't know what you feel about this, it did add another layer, which I think is interesting and always sort of kind of there, which is now exploring toxic masculinity as well.
Yes, I thought that was interesting as well.
Very interesting. So Kylo Ren and Poe. It's, you know, but it was done in a way that didn't kind of smash you in the face to say, you know, men bad, women good. It's subtle and interesting.
Well, it was character conventions as much as gender. And obviously we read gender into it because those genders tend to sit within those conventions. So Poe is the hot-headed pilot, the sort of mixture between Solo and Skywalker. And so we automatically... As you know, we're not going to spoil anything here for people who haven't seen it. We automatically see him as the righteous one. And, you know, this film makes you question, who is the righteous one? And I don't think gender, but gender is ingrained within our understandings of those archetypes. So I think you're totally right, but it's never pushed that it's about who's right, men or women. It's not about that. A question I think is fascinating, and again, we're not going to go into Last Jedi, but I think what is fascinating with when I see people talking about it, one of the issues is you know, why don't people at the top explain the plans to people at the bottom? It's like chain of command. This doesn't happen. Yeah. You know, people need to know. And yet, strangely enough, I think a lot of the issues in Last Jedi, which are probably also into Doctor Who, is that people have expectations of who should be right and who should be wrong, who is righteous, who isn't. And if you go against those, people get angry. No one would expect Captain Kirk to be there telling all his crew his every plan, because he never did. Apart from Spock, you know, when it's the other foot, shoes on the other foot, we expect the other way around. So there's a lot of interesting things in Last Jedi. So I think Last Jedi will be, for between the two of us, our recommendation of the week is go and see Last Jedi. Strip back your ideas of what it should be doing, because I think that is where a lot of people are upset. And I think it's sad that people are upset about it, because, you know, they're fans of this show, of this franchise. They want to go in, they want to enjoy it. And if they're frustrated, they can't help that. They've come out, it's not done what they wanted. And that's a horrible thing.
This is true. And, you know, I come back to, I think that we're all heavily invested in Doctor Who.
Yeah.
But we do reserve the right to be disappointed by what we've seen.
Absolutely.
You know, this idea that... And there's something deep-rooted in Doctor Who fandom that we must not criticise, that if we criticise, the show will be taken off us, because that's what happened in the 80s. And I think that there is a degree where that was true, where the rabid fan press was one of the reasons why they just thought, oh, we can take this off because even the fans hate it. But this idea that if Doctor Who isn't doing it for us, that we must keep quiet or it will go away, it's exactly the wrong thing to say.
Yeah.
You know, and Doctor Who going off the air in 1989 was more of a tragedy for us than it would be now, because there was nothing like Doctor Who on the TV, which is why it's been such an influential show for so many writers and actors, because you watched Doctor Who or you watched an American import and that was it for your TV sci-fi. Now, I could wake up and watch nothing but sci-fi from dawn till dusk, new sci-fi, or sci-fi for the last couple of years on Netflix. It would never go. It would never leave me. There is always something new and interesting, and it's a genre that has exploded in terms of content with thousands of hours to enjoy every year. So at that point, do, you know, because at some point Doctor Who will come off the air again, without doubt, because it will have to, because one of the problems with long-running soaps like Coronation Street is you can't now take it off air for a year, retool it heavily and bring it back. You have to, it's always having to fix this machine that's running constantly, and you can only do so much to it. But Doctor Who at some point will come off and change for whatever reason. And I think we just have to embrace it. But it's okay not to like Doctor Who. And that's one of the subtexts. There's almost been this sort of insidious creeping thing in recent years where we must be kind. We must always be kind to Doctor Who. And it's a privilege to have Doctor Who. We must always love it unconditionally. And I don't buy that anymore, I'm afraid.
No, I don't either. And like you say, that's why I tend to see myself, as I keep saying on this podcast, I see it as being a critic rather than a fan, because I watch so much stuff these days and I can't say I'm a fan of everything. I have a long-term experience of Doctor Who. I will judge it as critically as I'll judge Star Wars, as I'll judge a new series, or I'll judge anything you ask me to judge. I don't think it's about having to sort of support something needlessly. I think you support it by being honest, but I think you need to support it by being critical, and I think you've got to be open-minded to some of the arguments.
I would agree. I think negativity for the sake of it, and when it becomes focused on a particular person,
yes,
you know, as happened in the 80s with John Nathan Turner, as happened with Russell, you know, lots of people hated Russell's guts and hated his take when it brought it back, as has happened with Stephen Moffat,
yes,
where lots
absolutely.
Of people hate him. As will happen with Chris Chibnall, where he will invariably become... Well, yes, a poor bugger. Nobody's seen any of his stuff.
Yeah.
And people are already declaring they won't watch it. So it's that old... it's that line from Evil of the Daleks where, you know, where the good Daleks are going, yes, we will obey, but not without question.
And I think it
has to be that.
And I think the final thing to say, and this applies to all everyone out there, whatever you're debating, because it's obviously with the big political issues of the day, it's even more evident, is that you don't win the argument by belittling the other side. It just doesn't work.
Exactly.
Whether you're talking Trump, Brexit, Doctor Who, it doesn't matter what level. If you end up just, because you just validate the other side's opinion that your side is unreasonable. You never see yourself as being unreasonable. So if the other people suddenly seem unreasonable, they will not listen. But if you stay calm, you talk fairly, you accept that you're not necessarily going to change people's opinions, but you never know. You might give them something new to think about. And with things like Doctor Who, maybe it will mean you might offer them something that might mean when they go back to it, they'll enjoy it more. I tend to do that with plot holes. When people start to talk about plot holes, often they're not. They're just bits
that haven't been sufficiently explained,
either for time or for edit. But they are things to talk about. And sometimes when you talk about them, you can take away. One of the recent ones was in one of the groups. They were talking about Legopolis, and they were saying, "Where do the police go at the end of Legopolis to the beginning of Castrovalva?" And you think, "Well, okay, that's a fair point. How can we explain this away?" And you could say, well, you're dealing with the moment where the Watcher is one of the most is an entity that's beyond the Doctor.
A powerful entity, yes.
But, you know, policemen interfering with the regeneration would probably be stopped. Not in any vicious way, but they'd become out of the equation. And as soon as you say that, if you can find a credible answer to something, maybe it means the next time that person watches Legopolis, that'll be in their head, that won't become a frustration anymore. So you can have discourse which is positive without being, you know, negative. And it's the same thing with Jodie and this change and this gender issue. People want to love the show. They have an issue with it. If you can find ways of talking to people that might actually mean that they'll approach it and feel less, you know, with some ideas that might make it less problematic for them, that could be a good thing. And ultimately, also, I think it's good to understand why people are frustrated. What is it that upsets them, and try and understand why it upsets them. You know, we need to learn empathy.
We do, and you know, making a show, making any creative endeavor is a collaborative effort, and you always invariably end up upsetting someone.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
You know, I don't know if you saw on Facebook, I got trolled on Twitter by I put a simple tweet up that said I'd really enjoyed that Star Wars documentary, How the British Made Star Wars, and I'd put up a tweet that said, oh, brilliant documentary on BBC4, eschews the obvious in favour of something very fresh. Really enjoyed it. Anyway, some bloke who followed me on Twitter, who tweeted, blech, you know, why is it that nerds feel that they have to use big words like eschewed to discuss a children's programme? It's not for kids, honest, it's proper film. And then a couple of his mates joined in, and I couldn't believe what I was reading. And then I looked at, you have to look at the people who were tweeting it. And the first guy was doing it from a protected account, but had bizarrely followed me. So why he'd followed me when all I tweet about was, you know, Horns of Nymon is beyond me. He was like some huge political activist whose entire Twitter thing was like, he was like a sort of, to me, he looked like a sort of low rent, sort of almost sort of student-y Che Guevara, but he obviously thought he was Andrew Neil. And then his mate, who was bantering with him, was a leading light of the British stamp collecting and coin collecting world. You know, which you know, in that sort of Two Ronnies sketch world, I considered them to be nerdier than me.
Ah, this is it.
I was looking down on them going, oh, you laugh at me for my high-quality, very popular Doctor Who views, you know, whereas you lot are having a thrill over bits of paper with gum on the back of it, and, you know, and who's just been made parliamentary undersecretary for pencils.
And so, it's a sad thing, because cultural conventions on who has power, value, and is so ridiculous. I mean, I met a girl... Oh, I know a girl about a year. I've seen her a couple of times. She's a scientist. She's done trips to China and all sorts of places with either to do with her with biology or just to do with exploring. She's a coin collector, and she loves it because she loves to find coins from different times and different places, and she finds it fascinating and breaks that stereotype of the nerdy boy with his coins, you know, racked up in special cellophane or whatever.
Yeah.
Or the idea of the stamp collector, or the Doctor Who collector, or, you know, the football fan who is, as we've always said before, is no different to the sci-fi fan. You know, sci-fi fan might wear a Captain Kirk.
I had this out with my old business partner, who is a rabid Spurs fan and hates Doctor Who. I would take the piss every now and again. And I'd say, listen, I said, if I asked you to tell me the team, including substitutes, that walked out for the FA Cup final for Tottenham in 1981, I said, you could reel it off. You could tell me the formation. You could tell me who the substitutes were. You could tell me the score. You could tell me what minute they score in. I said, how is that any different? Oh, well, it just is.
That's the thing, isn't it? It just is. So again, as we lecture and patronise you all, just remember that it is often just cultural values which are dictating who is worthy and who isn't, and it's all the same deal. So be kind. If you're anti the Jodie thing, be mindful and thoughtful. And if you're pro it, be aware that, you know, people believe what they believe, and if you feel that the things that they could be, I don't want to use the word educated because that's patronising. If there are ideas,
don't use it as a stick to beat them with.
Exactly. Talk to them. Because... talk to each other. Learn from each other.
Yeah, which is a very Doctor Who message.
Well, I think it is. I mean, we all sit on there, even in this podcast. I mean, myself and Christian have, as we've said, we know we have different perspectives on this change of era. And that's fine. That's good. You just got to listen to each other and accept that we're not all going to think the same. And that's good, because that's where good creativity comes.
I haven't loved every single era of Doctor Who unconditionally.
Absolutely.
I'll be quite honest. I remember not being hugely happy with Colin Baker and his second year being awful.
Yeah.
I remember Sylvester's first year being dreadful. I remember being actually embarrassed to be a Doctor Who fan in that first year. It was just awful. I remember watching, you know, and you must get this as a Doctor Who fan over the years. I still get it, but I used to get it a lot more then. There's always some bastard, usually at a wedding or something else, says, haven't you grown out of this yet? Or when do you think you're going to grow out of this?
Yeah.
It's that there's certain lines which can still cut straight through our perfectly crafted, cool personas, and wham us straight through the heart like a harpoon.
But does he realise that even a Doctor Who fan can key his car?
Oh, yes.
Sorry, carry on.
Well, right, yes. so it's... I think that I have... And there's whole chunks of Doctor Who which I don't watch, I don't experience at all with Big Finish. You know, there's thousands of hours of Doctor Who, officially sanctioned Doctor Who with all the actors and everything, that I've never experienced because I don't experience it.
So if we're going to finish this off, and I think if we're trying to finish off on a positive note, and this is the end of a tenure, a producer's tenure, I'm going to ask you two questions. Mm-hmm. I'd like you to name your favourite Stephen Moffat story, and I'd like you to name your favourite Capaldi story.
Oh, well, let's see. I would say that both of them end up being Heaven Sent.
Okay.
Heaven Sent was perhaps the most extraordinary 50 minutes of television I remember seeing in living memory. Conceptually strong, music, design, dialogue, but the very idea, you know, the very idea that the Doctor's in this trap and is just, you know, inching his way through that diamond wall over several billion years. I mean, for me, they do blow it with Hellbent. Yeah. But I don't think of it as a two-parter. I think of that as a standalone. That is art house Doctor Who for me at its strongest, at its finest. I would watch that again and again and again, which I guess it's a metaphor for anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, of how we've watched, you know, Star Wars 320 times or Horns of Nymon 100 times, that we just come back and back and back to the same thing, that it gives us comfort and it gives us something to hang on to in quite a horrible world. So yeah, that, which is what I say, you know, Stephen Moffat has written two of the greatest pieces of Doctor Who ever, and he's also overseen some of the most awful pieces of Doctor Who ever. So he's the ultimate enigma, I think, that we're going to have to take years to unravel.
It is shocking when everyone used to laud the horrors of John Nathan Turner, and you certainly see some of those elements played out again with the Moffat era for various reasons. I think I will go for... I've always loved The Girl Who Waited. I think there's just so many interesting and fascinating attacks in that on our position of ageism and of what's who is good and who is bad, and it's a very thought-provoking piece. And I was never over keen on Amy, but I think Karen does a fantastic job through
that. That's her moment in it, isn't it?
It is.
It's The Girl Who Waited taken to absolute extremes.
It is. And then there's the question of, you know, who should you be supporting? Either The Girl Who Waited or the young, you know, virile youth that we all treasure and see as being of greater value.
True, yes. Is the older battle-scarred Karen not worth it?
Yeah.
Because, that's
our Amy. And then there's that lovely line which goes against every time travel show I've seen, where she says, no, you're not changing time. I am me. I don't want to disappear for some younger version. What about my pain? I own it.
I've earned my right.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's
I'm a better person.
Exactly. Yeah. I am who I am. I've had a horrible time, but I've waited. That is for nothing otherwise. And that is, you know, a really powerful drama to create, where suddenly your two heroes become failed, weak characters.
I should
characters.
Dig that out. Watch that again, actually.
It is a really painful, you know, and
very
you see
strong.
Rory, who won't hug her, won't treat her in the same way as the young one, even though that is his Amy. But, you know, no, she's no longer, you know, in the Doctor's position on that, his guilt driving possibly a wrong decision. Yeah, lots of lovely things in there, which is brilliant. I suppose if we're talking about Moffat-centric episodes, the penultimate one of last season, whose name escapes me, where we have the John Sim reveal.
Oh, the world is not enough in time, is it?
Yeah.
That's terrific.
That is
that's
terrific,
really terrific.
All the way through.
And do you know, I never actually guessed that was John Sim. I didn't see that. So I actually even had the pleasant, oh my God, you were the master all along. That was great.
It was brilliant. It was progressive. It was thoughtful. The comedy balanced out with the drama. It was dark. Yeah. It was brutal. Sim had something fun to deal with, and he did a great performance. You know, all round, absolutely fantastic.
Was better than Missy, I'm afraid.
It really
it was a difficult one, that, for Missy, because actually Sim made the better master.
Yeah, no.
Better than he was with Russell, actually.
Yeah.
Although I liked some of his master with Russell.
So did I.
He had good moments, but the overall tone never felt like the master, whereas this did. That was great.
And I'd give a call out, you know, you always have a Doctor Who episodes which are sort of trashy stuff that you just watch over and over. And I must admit, I've got to the point where Time of the Doctor is one that I just actually, even though it's trashy and Christmassy and
it's fun, isn't melodramatic, it? Melodramatic. That entire world. And things like the wooden Cybermen of
Absolutely. And there's some lovely
The monoid puppet. And
Matt Smith is just, he fits that character like a glove by that point.
He does.
That lovely bit where he's bald and, you know, she says, you know, cover your hair because of your ears. And he just looks and he's proud of them. It's just beautiful. Yeah. And I, even though it's very wordy, that last speech, there are some elements of that last speech which I think are really nice. That, as I've said earlier, you know, that bit where and it's the way that Matt Smith delivers them rather than the lines, and he says, he sort of plays it rhythmically, or he says, you know, and it doesn't matter, you change, that's good, that's, yeah, that's wonderful, as long as you remember who you are, who you were, and who you want to be, you know, it's really well delivered. So even though it's overblown end for him, he performs in a way which I love. I think it's his performance in that I love.
I have a lot of time for the Doctor's wife as well.
Doctor's wife
again, Matt Smith, lovely at the end. And unexpected, actually. I mean, the era has glorious moments, beautiful, glorious moments. And, you know, if I was doing my top 10, I have a feeling it would be Heaven Sent first, Girl in the Fireplace second. I don't think Russell would get one until 5 or 6, or maybe 7. And actually, that's weird for me because I absolutely love Russell's era. You know, above all else, I think it's a shining beacon. But he also managed to get the best out of his writers.
Yeah, absolutely. He was a very good producer, which is where I think people forget. I mean, especially as, again, without rattling on this, he was very aware that this was a show that had to appeal to children, and that was the mandate. And as a producer, he made that far more key than perhaps his own personal preferences.
He also had Phil Collinson as his Spock.
Yeah.
Who could say, is this a good idea, Russell?
And you also had Gardner as well, who was far more a producer than, you know, Doctor Who. So I
who
think
would
he
say,
would...
yeah, this is a terrible. He had a great team around him, and actually, I think that they were more involved creatively, and they were equals.
Yeah.
They were equals. So, yeah, it's. So it's an extraordinary era of highs and lows, really.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the last series had problems, but...
Very satisfying as a series,
as
though.
As a series, yeah, there was a lot of good stuff, and he wrote a great opening episode. Capaldi found a middle ground between his rather sort of limpish, I found quite limpish performance in Series 9, where he just didn't really have any strength behind him, which I just didn't like that, to Series 8, where he was probably too brutal. Series 10... there was a nice balance there, and I thought it worked in his favour.
Yeah, there was. There was.
So, I mean,
the only thing that didn't work was the pyramid three-parter.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thing.
That was hideous.
Which felt like that was a sort of recycle of the silence. But
recycle
else,
of many things,
was,
yeah. And a lot of...
pretty good.
Yeah, Last of the Time Lords was recycled there. It just fell back on old tropes, and it just felt old and tired. But yeah, the beginning part of that series... up to that point, and most of the after that, bar the ending, which I think again felt like someone running out of ideas and a bit messy. But
it is a killer in the format, though. You know, I mean, Doctor Who's always been a little bit behind the curve, and I think the way drama's now going is that it's going to be broadly a single story with several actor-led sub-stories over 10 episodes is what we're going to get next year, or this year actually, and this is fantastic. This idea that audiences can't follow a long, complex story and indeed won't even tune in is made redundant by iPlayer, because if you suddenly tune into part 4 and enjoy it, then parts 1 to 3 are waiting for you. Or if you watch it all the way in one go, that's great, it's all waiting for you. If you catch it in 3 years' time, it's all waiting for you. So the model is redundant now, and I think something sophisticated, driven by a writer's room, it's super exciting, and I think that's why Doctor Who is going to feel so fresh. And I frankly, to me, the lead is not the change. The change is the showrunner, the format, the ideas, The fact that we have a new Doctor is, of course, an interesting element of the change, but it isn't the change. It's changed everything else.
Well, I mean, we're going to have to wrap up, but I think there's one thing I'd like to wrap up on, and I'll leave. It does sound like you're fighting a Nymon.
I imagine
they are, just slightly materially. It sounds quite materially.
They are. Yeah.
It feels
they're
like it's
very,
losing.
They're all very Velcro-y.
They do. They feel very Velcro-y. I just wanted to finish off, because we didn't talk about this. It was something you suggested before we came on, and I think it is an interesting thing. Is that you wanted to make an argument that the Christmas special...
Oh, yes. Christmas must go. I think this idea that the Christmas episode is sacrosanct and we must always have one has got to go. Nobody wants to start an era on one. So you have a problem where at the beginning and end of eras. Nobody wants to start an era on. You end up having to end an era on one, but you're divorced from the rest of the series by 6 months. So you have to end your era on a standalone 50-minute or 60-minute episode. And you're going out at 5 o'clock on Christmas Day, so you're out on an early time slot. And Christmas Day has a sort of must be light and jovial, except for EastEnders, which is given a pass because it's allowed to be horrific and violent, but everything else has to sit comfortably alongside the snowman and the snow dog. So the idea that you must have a Christmas special, I think, is something that needs to be consigned to the bin. Because very few of them are essential. Most of them are problematic. I mean, this year's ends up as a problem because, to be fair to Stephen Moffat, he didn't want to write it. To be fair to Chris Chibnall, he didn't want to launch his entire new era of Christmas, his new era with a 50-minute special at Christmas. So let's just get rid of it. And I don't think there is one next year. I think the idea is that Doctor Who just runs through the period that includes Christmas, and I would imagine it won't even be an episode on Christmas Day. It'll just go out whenever that Saturday is, and I'm perfectly fine with that.
I'm fine with it as well. I tend to find that slightly longer ones don't always work anyway. They don't necessarily become better, which is tends to be the Christmas episode seems to be a little longer. I think the seasonal element becomes constrictive for the writing because they feel forced to find some festive element to focus on. And yeah. I think Doctor Who at its best is not, as you've said, something which carries any particular positivity or negativity. It should be free to explore both, and Christmas again trivializes that. So I'm very happy with that idea. I'd be happy.
Let's ditch it.
So if you guys have if you've been listening to this all the way through, use the Facebook or all the various ways you can contact us, but let us know your favorite era stories. I think that's interesting enough. Let us know what you think about the idea of there being no more Christmas episodes. If you've got an argument against Gareth, and if you have, make it nice. Talk about this. Discourses, avoid the words social justice warrior, political correctness, intolerant, or sexist. I think if you can have conversations on these topics that we're talking about without those four, I think that's probably a good
thing. Oh, yeah. And don't say you lot hate it, so why are you watching it?
Yes, that one as well. Yes.
This is a Beyond Casterbrus podcast. Available on iTunes, Audio Boom, Stitcher.com, Player FM, and BeyondCasterbrus.com.